How do individual parents and teachers change the education system? Next on the K-12 Engineering Education Podcast. I'm Pius Wong in Austin, Texas. My guest is Suzanne DeMalley, author of Can You Hear Me Now?, a book based on her time teaching math in Baltimore County Public Schools, and based on her efforts to bring sound enhancement technology into schools nationally so students can hear better in the classroom. I started by asking Suzanne if her book is about how to change the American education system.
Yeah, I would say that it's a balance of explaining why I feel the public education system needs to be improved and then how to go about doing that using my own experience.
And I wanted to talk about your experience, but the first thing I noticed is you've done a lot of things. You've played a lot of roles. You've been a teacher, a math teacher. You've been a parent of young children in the public education system. You've been a CPA. You've advocated for change in your own local school system. What other roles have you played? Basically, how would you introduce yourself and what you do?
Well, I probably would include everything you just said. Like you said, my most recent experience is writing the book. And prior to that, being a teacher in the Baltimore County Public School System in Maryland. What led me into teaching was really my one child's experience with some learning difficulties, learning about his problems and issues, and really advocating for a technology that schools could use to help all children hear better. And you correctly said that I did advocate locally, but I expanded that to a national level as well. And then before that time, I was a CPA. So it's kind of a mixture of all those things, plus being a mom.
In reading your book, I noticed that you start off writing not chronologically in a way. You're writing about your experience as a teacher, even though you became a teacher kind of later in life. Why did you start out focusing on that aspect of your life rather than, say, your work helping your son?
Well, you know, teaching was my most recent experience. And the purpose of the book is really to focus on public education and the need to improve it. The reason I put my personal experience in the second half of the book with my son, even though that occurred 15 years ago, is because I use that as sort of a model or a guide for the reader to kind of figure out, well, how do I go about advocating for changes in the public education system? So, you know, I really focused on putting that in the second half because the book isn't, I really don't want the book to be about me or my son. I really want the book to be about problems in public education and then how to go about making it better for everyone.
Who's your book for then, Suzanne? Is it for those parents out there? Is it for teachers?
It's for both parents and teachers. Those would be my primary readers. But it's, you know, education is something that, you know, it's essential to a strong society, to a strong country. So I would argue that the book is really for anyone. And I recently had a reader reach out to me, and he is a lawyer. He is single. He doesn't have children. He only picked the book up because someone suggested it to him. And it wouldn't normally probably have been something that had, you know, flagged his attention. And he read it and then reached out to me after that and said, you know, he was so glad that he had, that he felt like he didn't really know going into it any of the education lingo, but he thought he could easily understand it. And he really, after reading it, felt like he needed to read it because he needed to also be aware of these issues.
Yeah, you write to many people, I feel like. You directly address people in your book. One of the groups of people you directly address kind of early on is teachers. I was wondering if you could actually narrate one small section of that.
Okay. Teachers, how many times have you felt powerless in your classroom? How many times have you sat through trainings and staff meetings being told that you have to use a curriculum that you know is not the most effective for your students? that you must adhere to pacing guidelines that aren't realistic given the academic needs of your class, that you have to relinquish too many instructional days for standardized testing just to yield results that you already know, that you can't remove a student from class who is repeatedly distracting and disrupting the learning environment for all of the other students in the room, and that you can't give a child the help they really need and deserve because there are too few supports for too many struggling students.
When you asked all these questions to teachers, are these questions that you and your colleagues already asked? Are these problems that you yourself faced? How did you come up with these particular questions?
Yeah, I mean, those were thoughts and questions that I had in my mind all the time as a teacher, during staff meetings, during professional development trainings, you know, at the very beginning of the year when you come back to school and they're showing you the standardized testing scores from the year before and giving you the information, your students and the curriculum and the new pacing guidelines, and you're looking at what the students are what knowledge they're coming in with, and you're looking at those pacing guidelines and saying, there's no way, like, I'm going to be able to cover this material in X amount of time when I have kids coming in that are already 2 years behind where they should be. You know, and I know that I'm not alone in having those feelings and asking those questions. I've heard my colleagues in the school that I worked at, you know, say and ask the same kind of things. And I heard from other teachers when I would attend professional development trainings, you know, thinking the same thoughts. So, yeah, that was very personal for me to write that.
And it seems like you proposed some ideas, I guess, for answering some of those questions or how to solve some of those problems. Do you feel like you have a good idea of how to address each of these things?
Well, no, I make it very clear in the book that, you know, the purpose of the book is that not that I am providing all of the answers. It's really the purpose of the book is to, you know, educate everyone, including the teachers, really about the background of what went into some of these policies that were created. You know, what was the intent behind the policies? What are some of the laws that are behind the policies? And then to, you know, share my own experience having to deal with those policies and practices in the classroom every day. And to then, you know, I do give some of my own opinions, what I thought worked and what I thought didn't work and what I thought could work better. But I'm definitely not saying, you know, no, you have to read this book. And then I'm saying, let's throw everything out the window and use my ideas. I want everyone to read this book and increase their knowledge and then share their own experiences and come to a conversation that I think needs to be had by parents and teachers, the people at the ground levels who really are the ones who take care of the children that are impacted by good and bad decisions in the education system that are made. So I would like those people to come together and contribute to a conversation to work towards a better system. And that's really the goal.
In your book, you do write about your personal experience as a teacher. You started teaching in 2009, correct?
No, it was actually 2009 was when I went back to school to get a master's degree to become a teacher.
Got it.
I started teaching actually in 2011.
Okay. I mean, you still taught for a long time since 2011. Why did you do that at that time, at that age? Because you already said, or we already know, that you were working in business prior to that. What made you make that jump?
Well, in 2005, my son, who was in kindergarten, was diagnosed with an auditory processing deficit. And I didn't know what that meant. So I had to do a lot of research to understand his problem, which, just for your listeners so they know, an auditory processing deficit is when the brain has trouble interpreting the auditory signals that are coming in through the ears. So sometimes information is slowed into getting processed to be able to understand what they're hearing. Sometimes it's kind of garbled and sounds get switched around. So it's a neurological issue. So I did a lot of research to try to understand his problem and then try to understand how moving into a first grade in a public school would impact his ability to hear and understand what he would be hearing. And then, of course, how it would impact reading and learning. And during the course of that research, I started uncovering, it was like opening Pandora's box. I started learning about a lot of hearing issues that are very unique to children, even children with normal hearing and not any sort of neurological problem. So I don't know if we want to get into those later, but I was uncovering all this research and I realized that classrooms are just not a very good auditory environment for every student, particularly young kids. And I also discovered a really easy solution to the problem, which was giving teachers wireless microphones and putting a speaker or more than one speaker in the classroom so that that teacher's voice could be just spread throughout the entire room rather than directed to wherever that teacher or directed from wherever the teacher was standing. So I started advocating for that locally and then nationally. And I did that for about 4 years until 2009. And then in 2009, I was just really passionate about education after doing that for 4 years, you know, and seeing the impact of education on my own three children. And I decided I really wanted to make a difference on an individual level at the student level. And so that's when I went back to school to become a math teacher.
Hmm. Talking about becoming a teacher, I feel like that's a huge decision. You summarized it in like a few minutes, but changing careers is huge. And you also wrote that you had thought about it even when you were young though, right?
Right.
Why did you want to be a teacher even then? And what stopped you from doing it right away?
I wanted to become a math teacher when I was in high school. And what really, you know, made me want to do that is my own personal learning experience with math. When I entered middle school, I was put into an accelerated math group and I just started drowning. I just was really struggling with it. The algorithms weren't making sense to me. I didn't know why we had to do the steps that we were being told to do. At that time, it was more of a memorization of steps and it just didn't make sense to me. It wasn't clicking. And I really started struggling with it. And I really developed a very intense anxiety to math, which I've learned recently I've actually learned that there's really a diagnosis for math anxiety. I didn't know that back then, but that's definitely what I had. That anxiety just affected my self-esteem and my ability to learn. I would literally just freeze up in class and not be able to do the most simple things that I could normally do. So I went through that and I really struggled and I didn't like school because of it. And when I entered high school, I started off with a math teacher that was just great and really helped me. I wouldn't say overcome the anxiety. I think I still have it today, but just to manage it and deal with it and still enjoy learning. And I the math just started clicking with me and I think it was probably a combination of just the teacher, maybe some just development, neurological development, maybe things were clicking better. I don't know what it was. And also probably just being able to deal with that anxiety and not have it just be so restrictive. But I started loving math and I enjoyed math from really ninth grade on. I just loved it. And I decided, I really want to be able to do this kind of thing for other people and other students and just help them to enjoy math and be able to learn it. And, for those kids that struggled with it and the kids that loved it, I really wanted to be helping them with it. So that's what I wanted to do. I didn't do that because there was a lot of pressure in my family, I think, to go into business and accounting. And I had won a scholarship to college from an accounting firm that my dad worked for. And so there was just a lot of pressure, and I ended up sort of going in a different direction for that reason.
Right. It's interesting. One of the things you mentioned was that math anxiety that you recognized you had. Later on, you would become a math teacher for elementary school kids. Did you recognize math anxiety amongst your students?
Oh, yes. I think it's very common from not only for children to have that sort of fear of math, whether it's, you know, an abnormal fear or just a normal fear. But adults have it as well. And, you know, a lot of times parents would even come in for conferences and say, well, you know, I'm not good at math. You know, they immediately start off by saying that I'm not good at math. That's why my child's struggling, or I can't help them at home because I don't know how to do this stuff myself. So I think it is very common. And yeah, I think I got a lot of pleasure out of being able to help kids that would start off the year not really strong in math and not feeling good about it. And then at some point during the year, you know, they'd say, I love this. I love doing this. You know, whether it ended up being their thing or not, they were enjoying it. They enjoyed the learning. And as a teacher, I think that's probably the most satisfying part of your job.
So let's talk more about your teaching then, I guess, because that's kind of where your book starts off. You talk about one of your first full-time positions teaching math being at a school where your own children would actually go to. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious how that came about. Was that on purpose? You chose that, or and how did that work out? Did that affect your teaching in any way if your children were going to be there?
Well, it wasn't intentional. When I graduated with my master's degree and was ready to enter the teaching profession, at that time, the economy was really bad, and my district wasn't hiring new teachers. So I took a long-term sub position teaching math to the middle school that was in my area. And my son was currently at the middle school at that time. I think he was in seventh grade. My oldest daughter had already been through that school. She was now in high school. And then I had a younger one in elementary school. So it wasn't intentional, but I think it was very eye-opening for me because, you know, I had already had one child go through that school and my son was in his second year there. And I realized for the first time that, wow, being on the inside of the school and actually, you know, working within the system inside the school, I had a very different view and impression of it than I did as a parent. As a parent, I just thought the school was wonderful and that everything was wonderful and that, you know, all the students in the school were as happy and as excited about learning as, you know, my two children, that one who had been through and one who was there. I just really wasn't aware of all the problems that were kind of going on the inside, or struggles maybe between the teachers with dealing with a curriculum that they weren't happy with or assessments. And I just had a very different view of it. So it was kind of eye-opening for me. And I think that was, you know, one reason parents should be reading this book, because I don't think most parents realize really all the ins and outs of the, you know, what's going on day to day in their child's classroom or in their child's school, or what the teacher is thinking and struggling with and having to manage those piece and guidelines and using a curriculum that they're not really happy with. And parents just really aren't aware of that. So I'm hoping parents kind of get a better insight into what's going on in their own child's school or classroom or district by reading this book too.
And not to get too nitty-gritty into all the things that we could talk about, because you do go into a lot of detail about many different issues that you saw as a teacher and as a parent, but just to name a couple of them or get into some details, Common Core is a big topic in general, as well as in your book, I think. I find that you have kind of a complex interpretation or criticism or critique of Common Core. Could you go over, say, some of the pros and cons that you saw in how Common Core was implemented, at least in math, as you saw it?
Yeah, sure. I think, first of all, the reason that Common Core came about is because there was a desire to make sure that we had the same levels of proficiency throughout the states, and also the same standards that were really more rigorous and focused and specific than what we had prior to Common Core. So I agree with a lot of the intent that was behind the creation of the Common Core standards. I think that it makes it easier for students to move from state to state, which is, you know, common in this day and age, if we have the same standards in the different states. Mm-hmm. And I think it makes it easier then for schools to place a student that's coming in mid-year into their school, to place them if, you know, the school that they came from was using the same standards and the same measurements, then it makes it easier to put the child where they belong. You know, down the road with college selection, it probably helps colleges and universities to be able to choose their incoming class a little easier if, again, the standards are the same amongst the states. So I agree with a lot of the intent behind Common Core. And as a teacher, I really loved how the math that was aligned to the Common Core standards, how it really focused on conceptual understanding. I just thought that was great.
What do you mean by conceptual understanding?
Yeah. Well, rather than just teaching a student, you know, follow these three steps to solve the problem, it really starts developing the basic understanding using place value to really make sense of why you're eventually going to learn how to use those three steps to solve it. Mm-hmm. Like with multiplication, you know, it starts early on with just teaching them, you know, you have equal groups, and we could take that and we could, you know, arrange them in equal rows and make an array, and then we could break that array apart. And I don't want to get too technical, but it really, it does really go down to these very, I don't know, this fundamental understanding of each operation and how you're eventually going to get to learn that algorithm. And, you know, we were just talking about my own personal experience with math and how I got to middle school, you know, many years ago. And all of a sudden, I was having to learn all these algorithms and algebra and steps to solve a problem. And it just wasn't making sense to me. And I think if I had learned some of the Common Core math earlier, you know, some of those standards had been in place and I had a curriculum that really focused more on conceptual understanding, I think I would have been in a better position when I got to that higher level math. So, So I do agree with a lot of that. However, I think it was just rolled out horribly. I think it was implemented horribly. It was kind of just a very rush to put it out there and get states to adopt the standards. And states were all of a sudden had these new standards and they didn't necessarily have curriculums that were fully developed and tested that aligned with those new standards. It's a very different way of teaching math than it used to be prior to Common Core.
Right.
And the parents just were left in the dark. To the parents, it's like a foreign language. The way a child, let's say, learns, you know, multiplication today is just completely different than maybe their older sibling learned it 7 years ago or their parents learned it many years ago. You know, I don't think it's been well received for that reason. I think the parents don't like it because they don't understand it and they can't help their children with it. And there are things that could have been done to really, I think, help the parents get on board with why we were moving to these new standards. And some things could have been done to facilitate the parents in understanding how, you know, things are being taught today and so that they could maybe be more helpful to their children at home. Because, you know, if their child is struggling, not every parent can afford a tutor. And so I think there are things that could have been done better with the implementation. I also found as a teacher that kids that struggle with math and really have not very good number sense, those kids really have a hard time with the learning math under the Common Core. It's just because it is the way it's being taught today. You know, it's not like they're learning simple three steps to solve a problem. They're learning many different perspectives on ways to look at that problem and think about it and solve it and then explain it. And for kids that are really struggling with math, it can be really, really difficult. So I think my problem is more with the one size fits all sort of feeling that has come with Common Core.
One of those ideas might be to differentiate even those standards more. You write that as one possible idea for improving that situation.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I throw out because at the end of each of my chapters where I'm kind of just focusing on a specific area in education like Common Core, at the end of the chapter, I have some questions to help the reader then to maybe ask of their teacher or their school district about, you know, specifically about Common Core. And that's just one of the questions, you know, maybe we need to have different standards then for the different ability levels. That's one thing, or provide different supports. You know, I'm just throwing out some different ideas, but
right.
There are some improvements that could be made to Common Core.
Hmm. What do you think about standardized tests? Speaking of one size fits all and all of that,
right.
That's another hot topic in education today. And you do bring it up in your book a little bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What was your experience with standardized tests?
Well, I didn't like them because they take so much time away from instruction. I saw more time being needed for standardized tests once Common Core was adopted and once they, you know, came up with a test that aligned to those standards, which in my area, we used the PARC assessment. So yeah, there was the PARC assessment for fourth grade, I think took about 7 days of testing time, which is a lot of time to lose for instruction. And there was a lot of preparation that needed to be put in place before the test to get the child ready to take the test. Because initially, when the students in my area started taking PARC, they took it on a paper and pencil test, and then it moved to a computerized exam. And so that meant that we had to spend a lot of time sort of learning how to use the computer to use the math tools and how to use the other tools to help them, you know, like a highlighting tool or something, to take the exam. And they also had in elementary school, of course, they don't know how to type. So they have to spend some portion of each day then practicing typing so that they're going to be able to try to type their answers. You know, so I am not a big fan of standardized tests. For one thing, I wouldn't get the results of the test for my students until after those students had already left me and they were moving on to the next grade level. You know, those results didn't come out until late summer. So the results weren't particularly useful. And I don't know how meaningful those results are all the time, because sometimes it's the way the questions are asked or, you know, how they're scored that may sort of influence how the child does on it versus really the child's true skill level and their understanding, particularly for like the English language learners or kids that do struggle, any child that struggles with reading. And then also just the technical aspects of having to take an exam on a computer, that's very difficult for young kids, you know, to read part of a question on a screen and then have to scroll down to read the rest of the question and then sometimes have to solve it on paper, but then try to get their answer back in, you know, onto the computer and typing when they really don't even have those skills to type. So, you know, I question even how valid some of the results are for that reason. So I'm not a big fan of standardized testing. And certainly, you know, this year with the pandemic, I don't think we should be doing standardized testing this year.
You hit the next question I was wondering about. In fact, I think it was just announced yesterday that the University of Texas is waiving, you know, the SAT, ACT, all of those types of standardized tests to get into college. I'm wondering if we do away with standardized tests, this year? Should we continue it?
You're talking about like for SATs, those standardized tests? Or
well, any of them across the board. Right now in Texas, for example, our state tests, the STAR, I guess similar to your park, there's this big discussion of, are they useful this year or last year? And will they, are they useful in general, basically?
Yeah.
I'm just, it sounds like you're advocating just get rid of those types of tests.
You know, I,
across the board.
I don't know if I would say just get rid of them completely. Because you do have to have some measure of and accountability for the students and for the teachers, you know. Is this, are children learning? Are all groups of children learning? You know, is it equitable? And, you know, what do we need to improve? So you have to have some sort of measure. But whatever we have, I don't think should take 7 days. I don't think it should take even more time to prepare for and, you know, to get kids ready for. Let's spend more time on instruction and less time on testing. So I think the testing needs to be streamlined and the results need to come out sooner. You know, it's not meaningful when the results are coming out so late.
And I don't want to give an inaccurate presentation of your book. You write about much more than testing in Common Core. You talk about many issues like you mentioned ELLs or English language learners. You talk about technology in schools, discipline in schools, so many things. So one of the issues that I specifically wanted to bring up as well, because I feel like it came up a lot and I hear about it a lot in person, you write about there being a common request amongst educators to just hire more educators with smaller class sizes, and that maybe that could help in some of these issues. Why do you think that isn't done? Why don't we hire more teachers?
It's probably a money issue, and they're spending their money on other things like technology. That's, you know, one of the areas. I think that's really why, you know, in my book, technology is one of the subject areas that I focus on. And I do question the need for elementary students to have one-to-one devices. And I, you know, knowing that school districts are on tight budgets, I feel like there might be a better use of funds to hire more teachers rather than to spend money on, you know, every student in first grade having a device. I mean, I'm not blaming everything on technology. I don't mean to do that. But I think probably a cost is probably part of, it's probably a big part of the issue of why we don't hire more teachers and have smaller class sizes. But I believe, I think if you just randomly went into any school and went up to a teacher and said, what do you think would be the, you know, the most effective solution to addressing education problems and helping kids, you know, with learning, I think they would say make the class sizes smaller.
Has COVID affected your opinion on technology at all? I know we talked about it with regards to testing, but people talk about how tech, I guess, was critical in the last year.
Right.
What do you think?
Well, it hasn't affected it that much. I think if anything, it probably solidified my opinion. And what I mean by that is, you know, when I was just talking to you about one-to-one devices for elementary students, I do believe that every high school student should have their own device to use in school and then to take home to do their work. I absolutely believe that. That's going to help to prepare them for college or a job. Just, it's going to prepare them for the real world. So I think that's essential. And in middle school, you know, I do believe that devices are also very important. I don't know whether or not the kids need to be able to take them home, but I think it's certainly within certain classes, they should have enough devices for students to use while they're in, you know, in certain classes like English or science. But I just really feel like young children, I don't think they learn best from a computer. I think they really need to develop social and collaboration skills from face-to-face interactions. I think they need to learn how to share, how to use the volume and the tone of their voice, how that's going to influence the person they're working with, how their body language impacts how somebody else is going to respond to them, even just to develop manual dexterity using pencils and scissors, etc. So I don't necessarily believe that computers are the best way for young kids to learn. And what I saw in my school in particular, kids are using screens and technology a lot outside of school. They come back and on a Monday and you ask, what did you do this weekend? And almost all of them would say, I played video games most of the weekend. They're using phones and iPads and things. So I think we need to think about limiting their screen time. And I think we also have to consider that they need to develop those other social skills and personal skills at a young age. I think that's really important. And I think, you know, the pandemic, it was an extremely rare event. I'm 53 years old, and this is the first time in my lifetime that anything like this has happened. So I don't think we should necessarily like plan for technology with a pandemic in mind, because hopefully this is it and we'll be done. But the pandemic, you know, it also has really pointed out that children, especially the young children, need that face-to-face social interaction in order to optimize learning. They've been learning off of computers now since March of last year. And teachers were seeing that it's just not the most effective way for students to learn and for the development of young minds. So I think, if anything, the pandemic has probably reinforced my view that it's not necessarily the best thing for young children. And, you know, my other point in saying maybe we should limit technology for the young elementary kids, or not limit it, but, you know, we don't need a device for every student. Maybe we could have one for every 4 students or one for every 5 students and rotate using them. You know, my other reason for that is because school districts are on budgets. And I would rather see, if we're going to put money into technology, I'd rather see us put it into technology for teachers to use. You know, like I would love to see cameras in classrooms that have a recording capability so that teachers could record their lessons. And then students could watch that at home. And that would also help the parents then to understand how, that math is being taught under Common Core, because they could watch that video with the child at home. So I just think there's better uses for the money. And I think young children really need a little less screen time in their life.
Money comes up, I guess, a lot in education conversations, not necessarily in your book, because you talk about solutions that aren't just spending more money. Mm-hmm. But it always makes me wonder, like, if we just spent more money on education, would that solve a lot of our issues? Does education have to be the zero-sum game all the time, where if you spend money on this tech, then you don't spend money on this other thing?
You have to understand my background as a CPA, right?
Yeah.
And so I am very, I guess, fiscally conservative. And even sure. In my own house, you know, we're on a tight budget. So I don't necessarily think that we need to throw more money at education in total. I think there certainly needs to be more money maybe spent in certain areas of education. But before we would do that, I think we really need to look at how is it currently being spent? You know, do we have it going to the right areas? Because like in my district, we spent $205 million so that every student could have a device. And again, I don't really know that every elementary student needed a device. So, you know, that money could have then gone to something else. So we do need more money, certainly in some areas of education. But I just don't think we should start off by saying, you know, oh, that's it. Just write a blank check, you know, and all of our problems are going to be solved.
A major part of your book, well, the second half of your book, is about how to make change in the education system if you want to make change. And it's based on your personal experience helping your son, and not just your son, but helping lots of students get better access, better hearing, and sound in their classrooms. It sounds like an equity issue in a lot of ways, making sure that all children have like that good opportunity to hear their teacher, hear each other. In your experience as an elementary school math teacher, what were the major problems in providing equitable education that you saw?
I probably saw it most with the English language learners. I think that they are really being left out of the system. I think we need to make sure we have instructional programs for them that really support not only learning the English language, but support just academic proficiency in general, because a lot of those kids are coming to this country and they haven't come with a real strong academic background. So we really need to give them more help. And also, if we are choosing to use a program called the ESL program to help them learn English, that program strictly helps them to learn English and for a couple hours a week, that's it. And the rest of the time, they're sitting in a regular classroom and hearing instruction in all of their subject areas in English. And yet, some of them are coming here with a very limited understanding of English. So that's going to affect just their academic proficiency. So I do think those kids, you know, we need to do more to help them. I do. And I would also say we have a lot of kids that are just coming from backgrounds where they don't have a lot of, they need help, like social, emotional help. And we need more services in the school, psychiatrists and social workers to fill those needs as well, and to help the teachers out, because the teachers right now are trying to fill in all those needs and do everything else that they're expected to do. So I see those as really two big areas that are lacking right now that we need to get some help with.
Your book seems to be aimed at a lot of people who just want to improve the education system, whether it's for everyone or for their own children. And I wanted to ask about your personal experience again. You write that in the beginning, when you were first noticing that your son needed help, I guess maybe hearing better, you almost felt ashamed, like you couldn't ask for that help. Why was that?
Well, I think as a mom in the beginning, before he was actually diagnosed, I felt guilty just, thinking that there was something wrong with my son. Mm-hmm. And so I had a little guilt with that. And then he was in a private kindergarten at the time he was diagnosed. It was just part of a church up the street from us. And he was moving into the public system for first grade. And I found that when he was diagnosed in kindergarten, I was given all of the reports by the audiologist and by the psychologist that had done the testing on him, and a bunch of recommendations on here's what should be done in the classroom to help him. And I turned those over to the teacher and the director of the kindergarten. And, you know, immediately, like literally the next day, those changes were put in place without any formality. Mm-hmm. And when he moved into the public system, it was just very different. You have to go through a very formal process of meeting with a team and seeing if he's eligible for accommodations. And, you know, it was very difficult. It was like fighting for what I felt my son needed and deserved based on reports that were coming from all of these professionals. So It was just a really, really different experience. And I think probably helpful too when I became an educator and I was in those kind of meetings, but as the educator in the meeting rather than the parent, I think I had a lot more empathy for the parents in the meetings because I understood that they were just there trying to, you know, get help for their kids, and they have to be the advocate for their child. You know, I always say that being a teacher helped me to be a better mother, and being a mother helped me to be a better teacher.
If you ran into a parent or someone who was trying to advocate for their child or their student today, and they felt like they were hitting these walls, mm-hmm. where they felt like that pressure where they couldn't really speak up when they wanted to, what would you tell them?
Keep going. You have to. Mm-hmm. You have to. You know, you have to be very persistent and you do have to be patient, understanding that, you know, your priority isn't necessarily someone else's priority, but you have to keep going forward. So if someone says no to you, then ask them why. Get an answer, push for an answer, or go to someone else and ask the question of someone else. But you are your child's only advocate. So you really need to speak up.
Mm-hmm. As you were advocating for sound enhancement technology in your son's classroom, but also nationally, you ended up doing a lot of stuff, which I'm skipping over, but you ended up forming a nonprofit to help advocate for this technology. You had people helping you too, because of course, when you form a nonprofit, you got to have a board and everything. How did you find people to help you with these things, these allies to help you set up your website, to advocate for this cause in other states? Like, how do you get people on your side?
You just slowly make connections, and one connection kind of leads to another connection. One of my strongest allies in that whole process was a man named Dr. Paul McCarty, and he was a researcher with Brigham Young. And I got in touch with him because I had read one of his research studies and I had a question about it. I called the company that had the research study on their website and they didn't know the answer to my question. So they said, oh, we'll just give you his direct phone number. So I called him, you know, that was in 2005. And to this day, you know, we're still good friends and partners. And so then I developed a connection with him, and he then introduced me to someone else. And you just start to build those connections. It just take it slow. It's kind of like one person at a time. Never turn down an offer to meet or talk with someone, because you never know where that may lead.
Mm. And we should repeat that this was over a period of years that you were doing
this
work. It wasn't easy. It seemed like to me that what you were doing to advocate for this technology and do all this research and connect people, that was a job, like easily full-time job. And you were not getting paid for that. Isn't this someone's job in a state board of education somewhere to do this already? My question basically is, who is your counterpart for doing this? Did this not exist?
I don't think it does exist.
Wow. Yeah.
I know when I first started, I really thought like, oh, I just learned this information. I'm just going to turn it over to the Board of Education. They're going to read it, see the value in it, and they'll take it from there. And it does not work that way.
Hmm.
If you want change made, you really have to be the one to push for it and speak up. And that's the point of this book, is to really get everybody who really wants change done. And there's many teachers that feel like we need to improve the system. And there's many parents that feel like it. And to just kind of bring those people all together and say, you know what, let's all do this together. Because the more people that are speaking up, the harder it is not to hear and not to listen to them.
You know, I wanted to really ask more about your experience advocating for this change. One of the topics that stood out to me in your book was that obviously, since you're advocating for technology, the businesses and the manufacturing companies would be heavily involved in all of this. I think educators, whenever they're being marketed to, they could feel very suspicious of those companies. And I would say rightly so, because they've been burned or they have bad experiences or from other companies, that kind of thing. And you're seeing it from both sides as kind of a technology advocate and parent and also an educator, where you probably could have been marketed to by suspicious companies as well. It was really important for you to be ethical when you were advocating for technology. It sounded like you didn't want to take funding from the companies. You didn't want to be seen as you're shilling for them or something.
Right.
First of all, was that an effective strategy? Like, were you able to still get your message across without getting all this sponsorship from the companies?
Yeah. I think it probably made my message more effective to not take money from the companies, but it probably limited my the length of time that I could continue to deliver my message, because I didn't have the money to kind of keep going and working towards this. So, you know, that there's good and bad with it.
Mm-hmm.
I found that people were willing to listen to me because I wasn't profiting off of my message. I wasn't making any money if a school district bought the equipment, or if a principal wanted to use their discretionary funds to buy some equipment and put it in the school. You know, it didn't benefit me in any way at all. And so I think people were very open to listening to my message for that reason. Mm-hmm. They just knew that, you know, there's nothing in it for me.
Right.
But at the same time, you know, it just was financially very hard for me to do everything that I wanted to do, because I didn't have the funds to do it. And I've really hit a wall. I guess it was in the fall of 2008 when we hit the financial crisis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's really when it was like, wow, I just probably won't be able to keep doing this, because for money reasons.
Sure. Yeah. Because you were like taking time off to travel places and talk to people about all this. It's a job. It definitely sounded like a job. Mm-hmm. Do you recommend any quote unquote code of ethics for other similar education activists or advocates to follow when they're trying to make change? Never accept money from these companies, for example.
You know, I would say even like with the book, I think I didn't necessarily sit down and say, I'm going to follow these ethical standards 1 through 5. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I certainly kept had some things in the back of my mind as I was writing and editing the book. And some of them are just basic moral principles or practices. First of all, you have to be very respectful that other people are going to have different opinions. You know, opinions are formed based on an individual's knowledge and the experiences that they've had. And all of us, every single person has had different experiences. So that means we're probably all going to have different opinions and we're entitled to those opinions. So I think, first of all, is just make sure that you're really respectful. And I learned that when I was advocating for the speakers, the microphones and speakers in the classroom, I had some people that were acoustic engineers that were advocating for, you know, insulating the noise and the sound and mm-hmm. the noise rather than putting this microphone and speaker in the classroom. And what I would say is, rather than me going to them and saying, well, how can you think that? You know, I would ask, well, why do you think that's a better approach? And it made them more receptive to talking with me. And a lot of times we would find that we had a common goal, and there were some areas of overlap that we could agree on. And so it makes it easier to work with people when you kind of have that respect and you're listening to what they're telling you and you're being very, you know, genuine and wanting to know what they think. Also, I know with the book, I really tried to be careful. And I think you actually said these two words early in the show, I noticed. I tried to critique a policy rather than criticize a policy. You know, there is a really big difference. When you're criticizing, all you're doing is focusing on what's bad and what's not working. And when you're critiquing, you know, you're really examining the whole picture and you're looking for what's good and what's not so good. And I think that's really important that you take that broad approach. Because like with all of the policies and issues that I talk about in the book, you know, I think there was a lot of good intent behind like Common Core, you know, good intent behind giving one-to-one devices to all students, including the elementary kids. You know, there's a lot of good intent behind the policies and practices that school districts are using. Sometimes it's just that things weren't implemented properly or, you know, they hadn't really thought things through or the outcomes maybe weren't so good. But I think you need to look at it in the entirety and also, you know, focus on the policies and not the people. You know, I just don't, if you disagree with something, you know, don't spend time trying to have a personal attack on someone because all the people are going to change, all the players, just really, again, kind of focus on the policy. But I think those are just kind of general rules that I would suggest for advocating for anything, whether it's for education or something else. You know, I wish our politicians would follow those rules a little more.
Would you ever work in politics?
No.
Had to ask. Why not?
Definitely not.
If you have the knowledge
No. Just would not want to go there.
Sure. Do you think teachers should, like more teachers or educators should get involved in politics though, or the people who set these policies? For example, the Board of Education, they're elected people usually and may not be educators.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes they're elected, sometimes they're appointed. Like in my area, it's a combination of both. So I don't think that they have to necessarily go into politics, but I think that, you know, I do hope teachers become more involved in speaking out on their concerns. And I know that it's a very difficult thing to do because you worry about your job and you worry about, you know, your reputation and what score you're going to get on your next evaluation. And I hope there's some way that we can make it easier for teachers to be able to voice their opinions and their concerns and their ideas because they have a lot of great ideas. And they're honestly, it's the teachers who are the ones who know best, like what would work in their classroom at least. And that's the problem with some of these policies, is that, you know, the people making the policies are not in the classrooms, and they don't know what goes on day to day. And they make these broad policies that may be okay in one school, but not in another. Like, I really feel like we need to give more autonomy to the individual schools.
In your book, you have many instances, like several instances of your personal one-on-one reaction or interactions with some of your students. Names changed and everything, of course, but they're like these little vignettes, I guess, about some of your math students. What do you want readers to get from that, from those stories?
It's just a sample of the different kids that are in the school system that are really in need of a strong education for a better future. You know, they were, all of them had something going on in their life that, or came from environments where they had a disadvantage and they were relying on education really for better opportunities. And I also thought it was really important to put those stories in because, you know, my book does have a lot of facts and information, statistics, and I don't want the reader to just read all these facts and these numbers and lose sight of what's behind it. You know, it's the kids that are behind it. It's really important that the kids are always what's behind every decision that's made. You know, is this going to be best for the students? So I, for that reason, I just really wanted those stories to be in there. And that's something that some feedback I've gotten from readers so far is that they really enjoy that part of the book, really getting to learn about those kids.
Since your book largely is about getting your voice heard and trying to make change, it seems like it's kind of a privilege to be able to spend that time to really push to make change. Like, it takes a lot of work. How can we empower more parents, teachers? Teachers are already overworked, you know. How do we empower more people to make their voices heard if they really don't have time or money even to spend all this time pushing for change?
Right. Well, if you have a bigger group of people trying to push for change, it's not as much work for any one person. You know, like when I was advocating for the sound enhancement systems in the classrooms, you know, I was really doing most of that work by myself. So that's a lot on one person. Mm-hmm. I also think if the media would give some more attention to parents and teachers speaking out, you know, the media is like a big megaphone, and that's a really easy way to kind of get the word out. You know, we have social media is such an easy way to also be able to voice your opinions today. That's something that I didn't really have at the time, you know, back in 2005 to 2009 when I was doing my advocacy for the classroom sound system. So there are ways that you can express your opinions and your desires without, you know, spending too much time. It's definitely possible.
Finally, a lot of your book started with your son, Christopher, and trying to help him out. He's all grown up now. How is he doing?
He's great. He is going to be graduating from college this spring, and he already has a job lined up.
Congratulations to him.
Yeah. So, he's doing very well. Thank you.
That was Suzanne DeMalley, author of the book, Can You Hear Me Now? The K-12 Engineering Education Podcast is sponsored by my creative studio, Pios Labs, in Austin, Texas, where I work on projects in engineering and education, like podcasts, edtech, curricula, training, and more. Follow Pios Labs on social media for the latest news. That's P-I-O-S-L-A-B-S. This podcast is only possible thanks to savvy people donating to the show on Patreon each month. Help me continue the podcast. Donate to the show at patreon.com/PiosLabs and get some perks when you do. Visit the podcast website for show notes, links, transcripts, and more. Go online to k12engineering.net. That's K, the number 12, engineering.net. Thank you for your support, listener. Until next time.